Welcome back to The Powerful Patient. We're so glad you're here today, and I've got some things lined up for you that I think you're going to find very interesting. First of all, we're going to speak with Adrienne Ashley about her new book and about dating for people with disabilities and medical conditions, some special do's and don'ts that she has lined up for you that I think you will enjoy. And then later in the program, I'm going to play a cut or two from a new album by Mark East of England, entitled Utopia, and he has some really neat songs on it. He does hard rock and sort of Eric Clapton style hard rock, but his own unique way of doing, and I think you'll enjoy him. Mark himself has a genetic condition, and his music is his message to the world. So stick with us. I think we've got an interesting show ahead for you. I'll be right back after this message. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger, by Clinton Winford. And again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. So coming up first on the show is Adrienne Ashley. Adrienne has written a new book. Adrienne, tell us the name of your book.
My name is Adrienne Ashley, and my book is Every Single Girl's Guide to Her Future Husband's Last Divorce.
Catchy title. But I have to tell you that this book is not just for women. The book is also for men. And the discussion that we're going to have certainly applies both to men and to women. Let me read you a little bit from Adrienne's website about what she says about her book. You don't need to give up your dreams or your man. You just need a plan. The one thing missing from most wedding planning checklists is so crucial it could break your bank account, break up your marriage, and it might even end up breaking you, though you may want to pretend that your future husband's ex-wife doesn't exist. If you don't get real and get educated about their divorce, the details and the terms of it could wreak havoc on your marriage. I didn't write this book to discourage you from getting married. I was the second wife of my dream guy, and I haven't regretted it for a second, but believe me, I was grateful that I had put all my ducks in a row before I said I do. The number one cause of divorce is financial conflict. You need a map, a guidebook, and a compass in order to plot a course through the potentially stormy financial waters of marrying a divorced man. I asked Adrienne to tell us something about her book and about how it applies particularly to people who have disabilities and medical conditions.
Well, one of the things that people often don't think about when they're getting married is they're just in such a high over getting proposed to. Mm-hmm. Women in general. I mean, this is really what I focus on. But they're so excited to have been proposed to. And then there's the mad dash to find the ring if he didn't give you a ring, or to find the setting if he just gave you a diamond and a solitaire or whatever it is. But, you know, it's almost like the immediate rush to plan the wedding without thinking long and hard about planning the marriage.
So we're swept up in the romance of the moment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was.
So this is, you know, like a movie.
Well, you know, you'd think, and people don't think about it, but in the olden days, you know, a man had to come and ask our father for permission and
right.
ask for our hand in marriage. And so our family took on the responsibility of grilling the guy and making sure that he'd be a suitable fit for their baby girl.
Mm-hmm.
And now, because of women's liberation and how independent we are, we have to actually take that role on ourselves, and many women don't do that.
Right.
So they're not asking the tough questions and the hard questions. And the biggest concern that I have is in the second marriage divorce area, because you have 70% of second marriages ending in divorce. And why is that? Well, most of it is financial stress. They're not mm-hmm. talking about the issues. They're not looking at their credit reports. They're not talking about how they handle money, what their beliefs are with money, how they feel about money. Do they have issues about it? Are they, you know, living paycheck to paycheck because they figure they got $100 left in their bank account that month? They have to spend it.
Now, just as you talk about that, I'm getting feelings of discomfort. And so I'm sure that a lot of women are like very
uncomfortable trying to approach this kind of a conversation.
Yeah, they are. And let me tell you, and you're getting uncomfortable sitting there, but it's because do you recognize a little bit in yourself?
Of course.
And that's the thing. It's when people recognize that in themselves, they go, oh, that could be me. Yeah. Oh, maybe that's not a good thing. And they start to get uncomfortable because they're feeling like they're missing something and they're not doing something. And it's true, they're not doing something. And what they really need to do when they say yes to getting married is, before they start planning the wedding, sit down with their future partner and start planning the marriage. And I consider this, you know, not just an insurance policy, but as a marital partnership agreement. You wouldn't enter into a business arrangement with someone without going over all of the fine details and the small print and making sure that you knew what each of your rights and responsibilities were, how you were going to execute the idea, how you were going to get back on track if you got off track, who was, and then only 5 to 10% is how you're going to break up that partnership.
Right, and this is like the ultimate contract you will ever sign in your entire life.
It should be.
Yeah, and it is your life.
Yeah.
And, you know, supposedly, this is going to last until one of you dies.
And that's the key. That's the intent, the romantic intent. But in today's society, what I have found is that a lot of people are living in this instant gratification takes too long. We live in a disposable society. I'll get married now for romantic love. If it doesn't work out, I can always get divorced. I can find somebody else. I can divorce up. A lot of women think in the back of their head, if this doesn't work out, I can get divorced.
Trade them in, get a better one.
Trade
them
in, trade up. You know, and it's just not true.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of heartache that's associated with that. And most of the people who get divorced, I mean, the most, like 90% surveyed, they're not happier when they're divorced.
What inspired you to write this book?
Well, I'm a second wife, and like many of my generation, I waited to get married. So you already know, I'm a workaholic, and that's no secret. I write a lot, and I work a lot, and I'm growing my empire. But I met my husband, and I had already been working. I was already very successful. I owned my own house. I had a 401k. I had investments. I had assets. Just like a lot of women today, they put off getting married. You know, they didn't get married when they're 20 and then wait for their husband to make the family money. They went out and made their own money.
Right.
And so I accidentally did everything, almost everything right. I left out a couple of very key things that I make sure that I tell all my readers in my book. Don't do that. You need to cover all the bases, not just the ones I accidentally
got right. And it's not because you distrust this person. You love and honor this person. But at the same time, you have to be a little realistic about, you know, life happens. Things change.
Absolutely.
And, you know, if you decided to part company, then what are the rules?
That wasn't actually what I was thinking. Okay. See, I'm also an asset protection specialist.
Okay.
Certified asset protection specialist. So one of the things that I think of, it goes back to the old adage, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And it is exactly that. It is extraordinarily risky in the stock market or any other investment to have everything in one place where somebody can come and take it. So by having a prenuptial agreement, by having everything separated out, God forbid anything should happen, we could easily go in, get a divorce, hand the prenup to the judge with our distribution of assets. Everything would go, you know, the way we had planned for it to go, and boom, done. The judge would say, oh, that was in your prenup, go for it. And
I
so
see.
It wouldn't be, so it would be a way to keep assets out of the hands of outside third parties who are trying to get in. We're a very litigious society, 98
right.
million lawsuits a year.
So God forbid somebody slips on the ice in front of your house
exactly.
and sues you.
Right.
Then
and how many people own their home as community property with both people on the title? My husband and I never did that. He had two children from a previous marriage. I had all my own assets. I kept all my own assets. They were all separate property. We never commingled. And when some things did happen, that turned out that they ended up being able to nearly bankrupt him. And, I mean, except for the bankruptcy filing, that was the only thing left, which he didn't end up having to do. But, you know, they did take everything, but they couldn't get mine.
Uh-huh.
And so the family survived. And that's why I say don't put all your eggs in one basket, because you just don't know. And the idea is somebody's got to be able to pay the mortgage or the rent. Somebody's got to be able to buy food. Somebody has to be able to put gas in the car. And thinking about that, right? And having those conversations up front. I mean, I didn't have all of the conversations that I put in my book, because I didn't even know about these conversations until I got sideswiped. So now what I'm saying is, have those difficult conversations up front. Talk about what are the risks, you know? And speaking of disabilities, are there going to be any medical issues that come up that could really financially devastate us? And is there a way that we can work around it? Do you qualify for long-term care insurance? Is 6 years, which is usually the limit, is that going to be enough? Or do we need to do something where it's more like a life insurance policy from Lincoln Financial that has a long-term care component where you prepay $35,000 to $50,000, whatever it is, but then it covers you for as long as you need the disability insurance, the long-term care. So having those kinds of discussions up front, plans for the eventuality that your relationship is going to hit a roadblock or a financial stressor, or, you know, that you won't be sideswiped is my point. Yes, you're going to hit financial roadblocks. Yes, you're going to hit troubles in the road. And you're going to
stormy seas. That's the way life is. And it's not that it was necessarily be generated by either of the two of you.
Right. It's not. There's no fault involved. Because when you're doing that risk assessment as a couple, what you're doing is formulating a plan to not only strengthen your marriage, but ensure the longevity of it.
Right.
So let me just recap here for a second. What we're talking about is to sit down with an accountant, with some sort of advisor, and lay out what are our assets and what are the liabilities. One of the liabilities that comes with a divorced man is often the child support or the alimony payments that he's obligated to make, which can take a significant bite out of one's income. So you can't just look at the income. You also have to look at what are the obligations that this person has already incurred. And now that we have his and hers all on the table, and we can see what is the income and what are the obligations, now we should plan for what's the best way to protect the assets of this family unit moving forward. And one of the suggestions that Adrian has is that you may want to keep your assets separate so that if something should happen to take a bite out of the assets of one person, it's not taking a major bite out of the total family income, that one of you could sustain the partnership if the other one happens to get devastated. Very interesting planning, and particularly for people who may have major hospital bills ahead. If the hospital were going to attach the assets of one of these people, then would they be able to attach both? So very interesting questions to go over with an analyst. Let's take a little break here, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the oh by the ways, when to raise those oh by the ways, not only the financial ones, but also the medical ones. We're speaking with Adrian Ashley, author of the book, Every Single Girl's Guide to Her Future Husband's Last Divorce. Coming up in this segment, you're going to hear some pretty astounding advice, both for men and for women, on how to control your reproductive rights.
You'd asked me earlier, when we were talking about, you know, when do you bring up the, oh, by the way?
Yes.
You know, I
not only the financial, oh, by the way, but perhaps the medical one.
The medical one. And, you know, that's very interesting because a friend of mine is, we're both 39, and he's this hot attorney. But he also has Crohn's disease. His brother is autistic. He's got some genetic issues that run in his family, and it may or may not be a good idea to have kids. And that really hasn't been determined yet, but he's not really sure.
But at least there needs to be an in-depth discussion with a genetic counselor, and let's lay all the cards on the table here.
Before the relationship gets too far into it and she's already in love with him and has decided, kids or no kids, I'm going to marry him, because
Right. She may also be imagining herself with 12 children.
Exactly. And you know what? You got to find out ahead of time. I mean, for him, and one of the things I counseled him with was, you know, find out up front. If this is somebody who has always pictured themselves with children, you need to find out if they're willing to go through that in-depth genetic counseling, maybe do in vitro or right. something where they can do the genetic tests before the baby's a baby.
Right.
You know what I mean? Before yes. the baby's in the womb.
To do pre-implantation genetics.
Exactly. Right. And that's the whole idea, because with pre-implantation genetics, you know, that embryo is in a petri dish.
Right.
It is not a baby yet.
Right.
And you can make sure that that will be a healthy baby. Or you can, not right. 100%, but certainly rule out a good majority of risk
factors.
The
big ones.
The big ones.
Yeah.
And that was always, you know, myself, I was 34 when I was pregnant. I was going to be almost 35 when I had the baby. I have, I'm O negative. My husband's O positive. I had miscarriages before. So the idea, even though I had the Rogaine with the hair loss, the Rogaine shot, I wasn't sure that that was going to be enough, because my grandparents had three children and only my mother survived. She was the first child, and the mm-hmm. other two went full term, were born, and then died. Mm-hmm. And it's not 100% curable. So that was a huge stressor for me. I mean, huge. So, you know,
but these days, if they know that going into
they're prepared.
They're preventive things that they can do.
Well, so. They immediately do a complete blood transfusion.
Right.
You know, so at that point, what I would have done is had my husband throughout the pregnancy donating pints of blood, because the baby would have been O positive.
Right.
And I'm O negative. And so, you know, there was the concern. There was a lot of concerns. And I was, you know, I'm not normally a nervous person, but this was my one thing that had always scared the
sure.
living bejesus out of me.
Of course.
So, you know, and rightfully so, because it affected my family and hit me. And
sure.
So, you know, at 11 weeks, I had a CVS test instead of waiting to 26 weeks for an amnio.
Chorionic villus. What's the S stand for?
I haven't got the faintest idea. It's a CVS test, and every single OB on the planet knows what it is. And if you, and the only yeah. thing is, you know, there's a higher risk of spontaneous miscarriage than with an amnio, but you know what? The risk of having to wait another 15 weeks to my psyche was not going to be good.
Right. So they take a sample of the placenta at that point, right?
Weeks.
11 weeks.
11 weeks. So then I had that. And basically the only thing that doesn't check for is spina bifida. So after 26 weeks, all I needed was a blood test to see if there was spinal fluid in my bloodstream. And then that, if there wasn't, then obviously that wasn't an issue. So for me, that made me a much more natural and relaxed mom to be.
Right.
So knowing ahead of time what your issues are.
Knowledge alone is very comforting. There are three methods that are mentioned in this interview on how to do genetic profiling of an unborn child. IVF, or in vitro fertilization. The second is CVS, or chorionic villus sampling. The third is an amnio, or testing the amniotic fluid. And they're done at different stages of a pregnancy. IVF is done before the pregnancy ever begins. The egg is taken from the mother, the sperm is taken from the father. They're put together in vitro, in glass, is what that means, in the laboratory. So they're in one of these little glass dishes, which is known as a petri dish, in the laboratory. From that, they can take one of the first 8 or 16 cells in the blastomere before it even becomes an embryo and test that to see whether the genetic flaw that you're concerned about has been transmitted here or not. And then, depending on the answer to that question, one could choose to implant that blastomere in the womb or not. So this is before a pregnancy ever gets off the ground. We could do some testing. Then the other two happen later on in the pregnancy. A chorionic villus sampling, usually somewhere around 10 or 11 weeks, That's where they go in and they take a tiny sample of the placenta, from the fingers of the placenta, which are called the villi, and they can test that material to see the genetics of the unborn child. And the third one is testing the amniotic fluid. They put a needle into the amniotic sac, the fluid surrounding the baby. They take a small sample of the amniotic fluid and check that to see what the baby's genetic profile might be. So these are ways to learn what the genetic profile is. And then based on that information, you may or may not make any decisions, but at least you can prepare yourself for what may be ahead.
Yes.
You know, like my husband didn't know before I got pregnant that I had this little, you know, crazy part of my head that was super scared about that.
Right.
And that was a question that I probably should have discussed with him. Now,
so at what point did you bring it up?
Like right when I was pregnant. Then we started having all these discussions and I was like, for 11 weeks, I was like, ah! You know, because, you know, you don't hear the heartbeat until 10 weeks and, you know, 8 to 10 weeks. And so it's kind of like my period's late. My blood test shows I'm pregnant, but am I really pregnant? You know what I mean?
Right.
I'd had miscarriages before, so it was, you know, there was just a whole gamut of things surrounding pregnancy.
It's a hard time for everyone, and especially if you have a family history of some difficulties
of some
in this
difficulty.
Department. Sure.
Now, other disabilities. Now, for me, I have a busted ankle, and it's permanent. I have a blue handicap placard. And, you know, you've seen me running around and dashing around, and you'd never know.
Right.
Right? But I'm having good days. I go to acupuncture. I manage my disability. And if I don't go, or I really start eating crap again, which, you know, Dr. Keith Scott Mumby is here monitoring my food intake to make sure that I don't F up, because food allergies really do exacerbate physical problems and emotional problems. And he is the genius of that. They call him the world's foremost allergy doctor, and he is. And so we've identified quite a few things that exacerbate and inflame my injury. So, you know, and I still call
it. So on a bad day, you use a crutch?
I use a cane. I really am vain, okay? I have an executive sports seat. So you get it at Brookstone, and it looks like a little golf chair. And I still call it an injury. I don't call it a disability, even though it's a lifetime thing. Because I'm a, you know, former size zero cheerleader that used to stand on people's hands and pull my foot back and touch the back of my head. I mean, I still consider myself an athlete. In my head, I'm still an athlete, even though you know, I can do the splits, but that's as far as I can go now.
Hey, they're wheelchair athletes.
That's
so you're
right.
An athlete.
So but I still call it an injury, because then people don't, you know, they don't go, oh my goodness, what, you know, it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, you sprained your ankle, big whoop, you know, and it just, they gloss over it. So, you know, having that discussion with my husband, my husband's very athletic, and it took him a while, you know, because I call it my gimp stick.
Okay.
I mean, I make fun of it.
Sure.
Okay. But when he met me, this was before I started acupuncture, I did not go anywhere without my cane. I was handicapped. Absolutely. Blue placard, parked in the front, did not walk very much, could not stand in line at the bank, could not go grocery shopping on my own. Thank God for Safeway.com. Before that, web van. They had better produce. So, you know, I managed my lifestyle in such a way that it was not as noticeable. And that when I did need to do some kind of thing publicly, I'm an award-winning filmmaker, so I did a lot of the film festival circuits and a lot of the award shows and stuff. And I had my cane, and I would literally hold court. I would sit on my cane like a chair in the middle of a cocktail party, and everybody else would be standing, and I'd be sitting there, and I'd be holding court. And I would have a wingman who would go out and find people and bring them to me. And I managed my disability around my lifestyle. You know, I made sure that it affected me as little as possible.
You made some reasonable accommodations.
I made reasonable accommodations, absolutely. Absolutely. And like I said, I'm vain. So some of my little executive sports seats were decorated and, you know, fancy, because I was wearing black tie evening gowns with a cane, so it needed to be dressed up too.
Sure.
Black tie. But that was a conversation that was easy to have with my husband because it was visible.
Right.
Okay. There was no getting around the fact that I was a gimpy. There was no getting around the fact that he would look down and my ankle would, for no reason, swell up to the size of a cantaloupe. That was an obvious disability. But having a conversation about a non-obvious one, like my friend, you know, the haughty attorney, he's going to have to be more forthright about that.
That's right.
And that's the hard part, is when do you decide when to tell? That's really hard because, you know, it's almost like you got to make a gut check. If you think it's getting really serious or you're falling in love, I mean, before you give away your heart to someone who may not accept the whole you and all that that means. I mean, there's two different schools of thought. You've got, you know, once they fall in love with you, they won't care. But they might.
But they might.
And it depends on the extent of the injury. I mean, if it if there were no genetic issues for procreation, and it was like, you know, an ulcer injury or whatever it is, you know, where there was a medical issue, but it wasn't going to be passed on genetically, it wasn't a genetic issue, I would say there's less, that's less of an issue. Because when you're talking about relationships, you're usually contemplating or maybe contemplating or at least discussing kids.
Right. It's natural that the issue should come up.
And the issue should come up before you're thinking marriage and kids.
Right.
Because maybe this person that you're dating is not appropriate for you.
Right.
You know, and I think for me anyway, what I tell people is it is the most important thing you can do to decide for yourself. Kids or no kids, right? How far are you willing to go?
Right.
And once you know in your heart what you can do, then you need to choose an appropriate partner, because the worst thing you can do is say, well, I'll have kids because I don't think that you shouldn't have kids. I don't think it's fair to you to not have to not have kids when you've always wanted them, because then you're settling. That's going to create a whole plethora of issues later on. And kids are like barometers. And if one parent feels like they're in jail because the other parent got pregnant, you know, when they had decided not to get pregnant, accidents happen, you know?
Yes, accidents do happen. But if it was accidentally on purpose, that's not nice.
That's not nice. And it, I'm not saying it was. I'm just saying accidents happen. So, so one thing, you know, if you're a man and you've decided, you know what, I don't think I could emotionally handle the consequences of having a disabled child or, you know, have this genetic issue passed on. I'm already going to have a lot of medical issues. It's a lot to ask a wife to take on not only my care, but also potentially a disabled child's care. So if that was the case, I would say, snip, snip, baby. That's called personal responsibility. I also think all regular men, every man, should freeze their sperm and have a vasectomy. That way, when a woman wants to have your child, she's got to ask for permission. Then there won't be any, oops, I got pregnant on accident, on purpose, type of situations. So, I mean, that really is a radical thought. But men have no reproductive rights in this country. So, you know, if there is any concern whatsoever about potential genetic defects, I would say you're probably going to be looking at a Petri dish anyway.
When she says a Petri dish, you're talking about in vitro fertilization and potentially some genetic testing of the embryo before, before it's implanted.
So why not freeze your sperm and have a vasectomy now?
Right.
That's it would be safer alternative.
It would be the same procedure.
Right.
I mean, if you do freeze your sperm and have a vasectomy, then with your sperm on ice, then you can choose to have a baby, but the way is going to be in vitro fertilization, which is not as pleasant as the old-fashioned way, but it works these days.
Well, you know, I got to say, a friend of mine, she's gay, and her best friend from high school and her prom date is gay. And they decided to have a baby. And it was literally like I'm not kidding you, they used a turkey baster.
Yes.
So, it doesn't have to be in vitro. It can semi be romantic before the fire. It just requires an extra tool. but You know, I mean, there's all sorts of things that
you
can
do. But if you do want to do genetic testing, then yes, it is the in vitro fertilization.
We'll get back to Adrienne in just a minute. She has more views on how men in particular can protect their reproductive rights and make sure that nobody says, oh dear, accidentally on purpose, I got pregnant. Be sure to stay with us and talk more with Adrienne in a minute. I want to take a little time here. I promised you a preview of Mark East's album called Utopia, and this is one of his original songs from that album called Stop Playing Games. So very much along the lines of the theme of this show, let's listen to Stop Playing Games, written and performed by Mark East.
You're the one.
Stop Playing Games by Mark East from his album called Utopia. And we'll be back with Adrian Ashley in just a minute after this message.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
I should tell you, too, that Mark East is one of the many people who have been instrumental in helping us learn how to manage VHL. We're back now with Adrian Ashley talking about her book, but also more about her observations on how one can protect one's reproductive rights. Just before the break, you heard her say that what she would recommend to all men is to freeze their sperm and have a vasectomy. And that way, whenever you want to have a baby, you can have a baby using in vitro fertilization or, as she said, a turkey baster. If you don't want to do genetic testing, you don't necessarily need medical intervention to do it. You just need to thaw some sperm and use it. If you do want to do genetic screening, then you would be doing in vitro fertilization anyway. So this is a way to insure yourself against an accidental pregnancy or an accidental on purpose pregnancy, as you will hear her describe.
Process. Exactly. So if you're going to do genetic testing anyway, if you think that, yes, when we have a child, that is definitely something that I want to do to make sure to really look at all the risks and to be as conservative as possible, then I would say freeze the sperm now. You can find freezers anywhere from $400 to $600 a year. And trust me, that is cheap insurance. And if you have a vasectomy and your mom is always like, no, my potential grandchildren. It's like, look, I got your grandkids on ice. Don't worry about it. She'll relax. And the same thing for the girls who are like 38, right. 39. Just do what Jennifer Aniston did. Freeze your eggs. Then grandma will relax.
Because once you get past 40, the eggs begin to age. Yeah. And the chances of having a child with Down syndrome, for example, begin to go up.
And it's exponentially up. It's not just doubled or... Yeah, I mean, it's a lot. The rates are extremely sharp. Actually, it was 35, the rates got past my comfort level. Mm. And that's why when I was almost 35, when I was going to have the baby when I was almost 35 and I got pregnant when I was 34, I made them do all the genetic tests. And sure. I had like 5 ultrasounds making sure everything was good and, you know.
Our eggs have been with us from birth.
From birth. Yeah, we only have what we were given at birth. Men reproduce sperm daily. Hourly, practically.
But when we say that the eggs are aging, it's not just that you're getting to be 40, it's that the eggs are getting to be 40.
The eggs are getting to be 40, right. They've been around for a long time.
Right.
You know, you want fresh eggs, harvest them when you're 16 before you ever started drinking.
Well, I don't know about that.
But seriously, harvest them, freeze them, tie the tubes. There we go. No more teen pregnancy.
Well, I mean, when you talk about this vasectomy route that you're describing, what comes to mind are the pro ball players who have a girlfriend who just, you know, forgot that she told him she was on the pill, but she wasn't on the pill. All of a sudden,
forget.
There's a paternity suit.
She didn't forget. I'm telling you, you have no idea how many women.
For millions.
Millions. Millions. And I'm telling you, men have no reproductive rights in this country. None.
So the more assets you have to protect, the more this kind of strategy begins to have a certain appeal.
No. All men. It does not matter how many assets you have. I have literally gone into court with a guy who had degenerative disc disease, could not work, had no income, had no disability insurance because he had been self-employed, no state disability insurance because he was never an employee, and watched them impute him $60,000 a year in income and order him to pay $1,397 a month in child support for two kids when the mom earned $300,000 a year, lied to the court, said she earned $500 a week, was proven that she earned $300,000 a year. The court reduced her and upped her income from the $500 a week to $60,000, but then gave him zero timeshare and awarded her all that child support. So it does not matter how many assets you have or you don't have. It's all about, and the other thing, you know, in terms of paternity fraud, we have over a million paternity fraud cases in the United States, and nobody's talking about it, and nobody will deal with it. Mm. Well, here's the issue. By common law, if you have the inability, you are either out of the country, you're infertile, or you're impotent. By common law, and no statute can overwhelm common law, you cannot be named the father of that child. But other than that, if you are married to that woman and she steps out on you and has a baby, in most states in the United States, that's 18 years of child support.
Mm.
Even if that's the reason for your divorce.
That's amazing.
So
I see what you mean.
Fascinating ideas. Let's go back now to talking about disability and the issues about bringing up a medical issue.
So just bringing it up, getting past that barrier is probably the biggest hurdle. Once you've broached the subject, then it's going to be okay. But so there are many people who've been storing this deep in their psyche for a long time. Maybe they've seen some relative go through a terrible experience with a disease, and they have a certain terror about having it themselves and also passing it on. So any ideas how to get past that barrier? Because if you can't talk about it with this person, of all people in the world, then you're going to have a hard time broaching it with anybody. But a lot of people have kept it really deeply buried.
Counseling. One word, counseling. People underestimate the fear that they have when it comes to losing something good. And they underestimate their reaction to certain things. And mm-hmm. having a trusted, independent, third-party advisor who you can bounce ideas off of, run things by, really get that feedback. And, you know, half the time, it's hearing yourself speak. If you've taken the Myers-Briggs test, you'll know I'm an ENTP. That means I process my information externally. That's what an extrovert is for that test. An introvert processes it internally. Well, every E out there can't do it on their own. And it doesn't even matter if the person just nods and shakes their head. When I vocalize what it is that I'm afraid of, I can usually come up with my own solution. But I need to talk about it.
Right.
Right. And I can't just talk about it in the mirror. And I can't just talk about it in the car and talk to myself and look like I'm talking on the phone. You know, that would be great. I actually have to have another human being responding and acknowledging the pain or the issue or the fear and the challenge and have them help me help myself. And some people need someone else to say, yes, that's a good idea, and validate it.
And sometimes you can do that with a friend.
Absolutely.
Sometimes you can do it with a religious counselor. And sometimes priest, minister, rabbi will require that a couple come in and talk with them individually as well as together before they'll do the marriage ceremony.
Absolutely.
So that's an opportunity. But if that doesn't work, then one could go to couples counseling, just not because there's anything wrong with it, but because there's some barriers that need to be overcome.
Well, you know, one of the things that I tell people is, you know, a lot of people have money fear, right? They don't want to talk about their money issues. And I say that's where going to one of my workshops really comes in handy, because it's guiding you through it. And it's not like you're bringing it up. It's just on the checklist. You have to talk about it, mm-hmm. right? So it gives you that reason to bring up the subject.
Right.
It's on the checklist. This is right. the program we're going through. Let's talk about this, mm-hmm. right? And if you have some suspicions that maybe the person isn't being totally forthright and honest about something because they have this shamefulness, and that's what it really is. I mean, that's what it boils down to, is being ashamed. And because it's not a malicious hiding of information.
No.
It's the worry that information will change the feelings of your loved one.
It's shame and it's fear as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fear of loss. And so getting over that, you know, if you go through my program, the whole point is it's there to help create solutions to risks that you come upon.
We'll be right back with Adrienne to talk about how insurance can be more affordable. We'll be back after this message. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guides for this show with information about the people that we've spoken with, the websites that we've referenced, and some other background on the information that we've discussed. And as always, we would appreciate your support in making this show happen. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Thank you. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back.
So being able to have a roadmap and say, this is how we're going to plan around this. This is how we're going to solve this problem. This is how we're going to get over this situation. And then you have a roadmap to success because you've already had you've already come up with the risk, figured out what it could do to you, come up with a plan to counter it. So now you're safe. So if it ever does come up, you're like, oh, game plan. It's like an earthquake preparedness plan or a disaster plan.
Right.
It's the same thing, except nobody does it for their own marriages. And that's what I'm proposing that people do, you know, and especially with medical issues. Okay. One of the biggest components is going to be insurance. Do you have a job? Is your job the only way you can get insurance? If that's the case, maybe you need to start your own corporation. I mean, my husband's cholesterol is, I can't even tell you how high. It's high. And we qualified for personal medical insurance. Actually, I qualified back way back, like 10 years ago. And so I had it. It was like $140 when I got it. Well, last month it was $1,500 a month. And so that it was really becoming unaffordable. And when I turned 40 in October, it was going to go up to $2,500 a month. So that added to the fact that it didn't cover everything, that there was a 30% co-insurance payment, meant I was spending upwards of $30,000 to $50,000 a year on medical.
Wow.
Which is not affordable. Most people don't even make that much money.
That's right.
And let me tell you, my home equity line is showing it. So what we ended up doing was we took one of my corporations. I signed up with a company called Priority Payroll because, believe me, you don't want to mess with payroll taxes and doing it wrong. And I just started hiring all of my 1099s as employees, and then I got group coverage. And now our health insurance, 100% coverage, everything, including acupuncture and chiropractic, which it never covered before, which is the majority of what I do for medical, is $475 a month.
Wow.
So for me, it made huge financial sense to have my corporation be doing that because then I qualified for small business insurance. And a lot of people don't think that way. And it's not that hard. You only need two employees. And it's two employees or three employees, it's guaranteed issue. So medical conditions aside, it's guaranteed issue.
Which means that when you hire a new employee, they must cover that employee,
that's
no
right.
matter what their medical conditions might be.
That's right. Isn't that fun?
It is fun. Yeah.
So that's, you know, as an asset protection specialist, that's my little tip. But knowing the workarounds, and that's what I call it. It's a workaround.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that isn't something everybody knows. It's certainly not something the medical companies are going to tell you
right.
when dealing with disability. They don't want you on their plan. They don't, because you're going to cost them money. They want people like my husband on the plan, because despite his high cholesterol, he had such horrible insurance for so long, he never went to the doctor. We'd be paying all these premiums. He'd never go. And I'm like, I got a sniffle. I'm going, you know, because that's how I grew up, which is you
right.
nip it in the butt and you fix it.
Right.
You know, and it's just a whole different way of life, really.
Yeah, really great. So you finally broached your own medical issue, even though you were already pregnant.
Well, that's what it took.
But, you know.
Well, I was responding in fear before that by saying I'm not going to have any kids because I was so afraid of having to deal with it. I was so afraid of having, you know, a child that ended up, because I knew my husband was O positive and I knew that risk. And before that, I had always said I'm not going to marry anybody or have children with anybody who's not an O negative, because I was so afraid of going full term and birthing a kid and watching it die. And that was my nightmare. So that was my issue. And a lot of people have that issue, but you know, a lot of people also didn't have a relative who lived through it and watched it.
So for people in a similar situation who have that fear in their belly right now,
right.
what is your advice to them looking back on it? How did it go? And What can you say about breaking through that barrier?
I didn't have a choice. I was pregnant.
Yes, no, but I mean,
so I was forced to face the issue.
Right.
I would say beforehand, I mean, if I had known about a CVS test before I got pregnant, that would have calmed me down quite a bit.
So just getting more information.
Absolutely. Talk to the doctor, say, you know, be really frank about it. It's the whole point of what your doctor's for.
Right.
Is these are my issues. This is what scares me. This is what keeps me up at night. And I need you to reassure me that you can handle this and that this is fixable. The internet is a great resource, but it can also really, there's a lot of, I won't say fear mongering, but there's a lot of information out there that if you're not as skilled and educated in certain areas, could lead you down the wrong path and scare you even
more.
Yeah,
it's like when you're pregnant, not only do people tell you happy stories about their children, but all the stories about the miscarriages and all the problems.
Oh, and the 60 hours of labor couldn't walk for 6 months.
And there's some people who just love to tell you all the horror stories.
Oh, that was my other workaround, by the way, because I have a broken tailbone and a weak pelvic floor. And I went into my OB and I said, we're going to agree right now that I'm having a C-section or I'm going to find another OB. Because, you know, I pee 10 times a night in the middle of the night as it is. And the absolute last thing I'm going to do is wear Depends. Mm-hmm. I'm not that old.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, that's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we had that agreement up front. That calmed me down huge. And a lot of people, you know, in Europe, a scheduled C-section is no big. My scar is 3.5 inches long under the hairline and you can't even see it. So my doctor just happens to have trained with plastic surgeons and he's really, really good. And, you know, he was fabulous. But you got to have that confidence in your doctor that they understand what your issues are and what your fears are.
Right.
Because another doctor, a friend of mine had, said, oh, yeah, no problem. If it's going to be, you know, if it's going to be a problem because she had fibroids, then, you know, we'll just do a C-section. No problem. No, he didn't do it. And by the time that it got, I mean, it was too late. They made her finish. She had horrible tears. She couldn't walk for 3 months. That doctor, that was complete and total misrepresentation, and I would have sued him because he promised her a C-section and then said no.
That's not nice.
That's not nice, right? That is not nice.
I mean, it is your body, and you do have a right to be part of this decision-making.
Right.
And for the doctor to overrule her in the delivery room was really very much dirty pool.
Absolutely dirty pool.
So you do need to make sure that your doctor's really on the same page with you.
Oh, yeah. I wanted pictures. Just like a plastic surgeon, show me pictures. I want to see what we're talking about here.
In other words,
how good are you?
Yeah. Other people's scars, so you can know what is this going to be like. And
Exactly.
But the doctor needs to know all your considerations, too, because if he thinks that you're just afraid of labor, then he might try to overrule you. But
yeah, no, that wasn't it at all. I mean, he felt my tailbone. I mean, it's busted.
No, I know.
So it was like, and that's a, it's fine. And we actually started at that point and got clearance from the insurance company 6 months early to make sure that that was approved.
Right.
Because they knew ahead of time.
For valid medical reasons. But but that's why it's important to lay out all those reasons, not
that's
just
right.
your fears, but also all of the considerations that you have and discuss them with the doctor.
Because
it could be that you don't need, I mean, in your case you did, but it could be that someone doesn't really need a C-section. But
it depends on the mental stress and strain that they're going to have for the rest of the pregnancy.
Well, but it's also a medical decision.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm telling you, I was fine with the idea of pregnancy. I was fine with the idea of having a newborn, although I was scared to death. But my husband had done it twice, so at least I had a pro in the house.
Right.
I mean, but he really took point early.
Right.
You know, he was completely confident. He's holding this little teeny tiny little baby, you know, and he's fine with it. And I'm like, I'm going to drop it. He's going to break. I was a newbie.
Yes, sure.
So, you know, that was very stressful. But I had resigned myself to those two parts. But it was the labor part. I was like, there's no way.
Well, and people have other kinds of valid medical reasons. We have people with brain tumors or with a propensity toward brain or spinal tumors.
Absolutely.
You need to be sure to discuss that with the doctor because it could be that that alone is a good reason to do a C-section.
Well, you don't want that
so
much stress and pressure on your body. That's right.
That's right.
That's right.
And kidney function because your blood volume doubles and you pee a lot. So the load on your kidneys is much higher during pregnancy. So if you have any kidney weakness at all, you need to lay that out for the obstetrician and make sure that that comes up for discussion.
Well, you know, what was interesting was after I had Jack, I swear for like 6 months, I had like an iron bladder. I had control. Because I'd been using, used to carrying all this bulk and this weight and everything. And then it was like, whoosh, right. It was like I lost 50 pounds overnight. and everything was good. And, you know, I think it has something to do with weight. I'm sure if I lose 40 pounds, it'll be fine. But it's very interesting.
I think we need to go. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Really,
this has been delightful.
This. It's been great.
Thanks.
Many thanks to Adrienne Ashley for taking time to meet with us. Her new book is Every Single Girl's Guide to Her Next Husband's Last Divorce. And you can see that she has opinions that are broad-ranging and very delightful to hear. Next week, we're going to talk with Judy Fern, a nurse from California who has done a lot of long-distance travel herself, and she's going to share her insights from her travels to Mexico and Vietnam that will help Fred and me with our planning for our trip to South Africa. So we're looking forward to our trip to South Africa, and we hope that you will share in the adventure with us as we talk about that over the next couple of weeks. Next week, we're talking about the medical issues, how to stay healthy in the air and on the ground so that you have a happy vacation that's not interrupted with some medical issue. These are helpful tips that everybody can do and that really make very good sense even when you're traveling the United States for all that, but are infinitely more important when you're going outside the United States to territory that you're unfamiliar with, to places where there are germs and insects that live that you're not accustomed to. You're even more vulnerable to disease than you would be at home, and you need to take some special precautions and just think about a few extra things that we take for granted when we're in our own territory. So I know that you will enjoy meeting Judy and also meeting Fred Johnson, Althea Johnson's husband, who is going to be on this trip to South Africa with me. I hear from Marcus that we have 55 people coming to this meeting. And when you understand that we're meeting for a rare disease, people who are interested in von Hippel-Lindau disease, this is the first meeting of our 18th international affiliate in Johannesburg. The first time we have ever had a meeting focusing on VHL in South Africa, and the first time that we've had a meeting focusing on VHL in the continent of Africa. So this makes the sixth continent that I will have visited and spoken on with people who are affected by von Hippel-Lindau disease, and I'm finding this a very thrilling prospect. So looking forward to sharing the adventure with you. Stay with us. We'll be with you next time, and be well and be a powerful patient. Thank you.